This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's been 4 years.
Today, I'm declaring a state of emergency in Massachusetts.
March 10th, 2020, then-Governor Charlie Baker effectively shuts down normal Massachusetts life because of COVID-19. And what followed was immediately overwhelming for many doctors like Shira Doron of Tufts Medical Center.
It was just overwhelming panic and sadness.
And really for all of us. Now, as the old adage says, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. So we're going to try to learn. Joining us today, some of the biggest healthcare leaders in the region. First up, Rochelle Walensky, the Mass General doctor who became the head of the Centers for Disease Control in January 2021. When we spoke with her yesterday afternoon, she told us the moment COVID came home to Mass General will always be with her.
That day, March 6th, that morning, that call was such a stark moment that I feel like it will always feel like yesterday. I will never forget it.
Who called you?
Erica Shenoy called me after she had gotten a call from our microbiology lab that they had our first positive test at Mass General. I was sitting in the trustees room on the second floor of the Bullfinch building. I will tell you the seat I was sitting in. I remember it so vividly. And sort of coming up with, what is the single most important thing we have to do first and then second? And we had anticipated the moment. So we had been thinking about those things. It wasn't as if we were caught off guard. And then we started to execute.
At that time, it is so hard to remember, Dr. Walensky, what we knew when and what we didn't when, right? At that time, the first positive case at Mass General. Given your background and your experience, did you at that point have a sense that this was going to be anything like the magnitude of a pandemic that it turned out to be? Were you worried or suspicious that it might be, or did the magnitude catch you by surprise?
It was not lost on me that this could be what we ultimately had to tackle. We were certainly watching the footage from China and understood what they were tackling there. And so I certainly was hopeful that it wouldn't be, but it was not lost on me that we could very much be not only like where China was just in terms of the proportion and magnitude of the impact, but that we didn't necessarily see or have a plan for how it was going to end. Obviously, this was before we had knowledge and or vaccines in so many different spaces.
So, you know, if you were a firefighter, then this would have been your fire. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So what did you think? So now the phone calls come, right? What did you think?
And I will say it was two cases, not one. It was two.
What did you think? Okay, now my job is to, or this is what my life is going to look like, or now I need to, right? How did you suit up?
We had been doing a lot of discussions about it in our infectious disease community and in our and the community within the hospital and across the system. And so the question was, who needed to know? And then the other question was, how are we going to communicate to one another the important information that we were that was coming forward? How were we going to create teams? How much of this was going to impact us immediately? The patients, to my recollection, were actually not inpatients. These were tests that were, I don't believe, as I recall, whether they were in the hospital, but it meant that it was in the community. So what were the next sort of places in terms of our incident management team working within the hospital that needed to move forward? And then otherwise, who needed to know in the community?
Did the sprint start that day?
Yes. There's no question the sprint started that day.
And how long did you sprint? Did you sprint straight through, you know, sort of blew through the doors of the CDC, still sprinting, or still sprinting when you came back out the doors? When did the sprint end?
My last day at CDC was June 30th of 2023, and I sprinted from March 6th until that day.
What kind of impact did that have on you?
You know, what was amazing is that I was sprinting with just such incredible runners by my side. And when you need stamina, there is nothing like people who are working with you at the time to lift you up, to be there with you, to sort of be in the trenches, as they say. And so as hard as it was for me, for my family. I knew that I was with like people who were also working as hard all the time to do right by healthcare, public health, and the public.
We're talking with Dr. Rochelle Walensky, former director of the Centers for Disease Control and the former chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. What was the hardest part for you?
There were so many hard parts, and it would be really nearly impossible to talk about some of those hardest. What I would say is that first year where we early on had very little insight and knowledge, and we were really accumulating data and information all the time, where you had some of your clinical colleagues who were all of a sudden patients in the ICU, where there was a morgue truck outside of the hospital, where you didn't know whether your family was going to survive all of this, your eldest members of your family you worried about the most, just in terms of the data we were seeing early on, and when we didn't have a vaccine. So we didn't really have a plan for how we could actually emerge from this. And then as a provider, thinking about articulating, drafting documents of how we were going to use limited resources. Early on, it was masks, then it was ventilators, then it was, antivirals, remdesivir early on, how we were going to take those very limited resources and use them in an equitable, fair fashion. Those were some of the really hardest days early on.
You were announced as the head of the CDC in December of 2020. You went to the CDC, beginning of 2021. As you have said, it was a tough time at the CDC, both before you got there and while you were there. We're at March 2024 now. Are you at a point where you can really think about it and talk about it? Are you talking about it in a way you couldn't 6 months ago? Or is it going to be another 6 or 12 or 18 before you really can?
I will continue to think and learn and process about my time probably over the rest of my life, that there will be pieces where I will remember and say, that was a tough moment. What can I learn from that? And yet I had this incredible honor and this incredible privilege to lead an agency that in public health, we call it our Superman moment. I had this privilege of leading 13,000 people and other 13,000 contractors who worked tirelessly to make that happen and whose names you may likely never know. And because of that, I will always consider my time there the greatest privilege. They are an incredible group of people who do incredible work.
Let's use the Superman movies for a minute. You said it was you said it was your Superman moment, which I found helpful. So okay, one of the more recent versions of Superman, you have Henry Cavill. He lets the planet know that he's Superman. The military want him to come into custody, and he says no. And that's held up in the movie as one of the really smart, great decisions Superman made. In the original Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, he's in grief about somebody who's died, and he uses his power to change the rotation of the globe and go back in time. And it is clearly a catastrophic decision that he made as Superman. Mm-hmm. You know, in your Superman moment, what's the best decision you made, and what's the worst?
I think one of the most important decisions that I made was in April of 2022 to do the full agency review. That was hard for the agency. It was hard to sort of hold up the mirror and say, CDC has never had to, in its 76-year history, tackle a pandemic the way we did. Let's take stock of the things that we need to do better for the next time, because we all believe there is likely to be a next time.
That was an external review that you announced of the CDC.
Exactly. And that was hard. As you can imagine, the people of the agency had been beaten up for several years. They had been working hard. And to sort of have enough stamina and enough pride to say, we need to do this as an agency was really important. I think it was very important to continue to regain the trust of the American people to say, we will always continue and strive to do better. People wanted relief. They wanted a break. They wanted, I call it diastole, where it's where the heart relaxes. They wanted a little bit of reprieve. And instead, in April of 2022, we said, yes, we want you to have that break, but we also need to understand some of the things that we need to do as an agency together to improve.
So I'm going to play you some sound. We had a really thoughtful conversation with Dr. Sandra Galea, who's epidemiologist, head of the School of Public Health at BU.
Yeah.
He's written a public health book, Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. I'm just going to play the sound for you here.
If there's anything which I think we should have learned in the moment is that our instinct in public health towards let's simplify the message and let us tell people something simple and tell them it's clear, backfired. And it's backfiring over time as we see this loss of trust that I suppose I'm encouraging us to say, let us be honest about complexity. Let us be humble about uncertainty. And let us say that there are trade-offs. We might advise X, but we might understand why Y may be something that you may choose.
So, you know, he was talking about things that he thought public health got right and wrong. Obviously, you can hear something he thought public health got wrong there. I thought of you in the moment when he said that. And I'd read the book, and it was complex and fascinating. But I thought of you, and I remember thinking, would she say that that is always possible? Would she agree? Or would she say, despite the sacrifices or the pain, sometimes you have to keep it simple? Now I get to ask you. So,
of course, thank you. You know, I think that this is a complicated question, and here is why. We were receiving a lot of incoming that says, you got to make it easy. I have spent a lot of time over the last 6 months since I've been out of the CDC reviewing some of my own footage from the booster rollout in September of 2021. It was very complex. We had new data coming in every single day. And my job was to make sure not only that we got vaccine and boosters out to the right people, but that we had the safety data that allowed that to happen.
That was the first booster rollout.
Exactly. We were accumulating that in real time. So as I think about the instinct that people really wanted to keep it simple, and then the other side, which was many of my infectious disease colleagues saying, but you've got to speak to the nuance because it's not that easy for everyone. And there are some people who might make a different decision. And so if you make it simple, then everybody is potentially not going to make the right decision. And so how do you thread that needle in the moment? And even more importantly, how do you thread that needle because you only get 90 seconds of the news?
I was thinking about this earlier today as well. Was that 90-second thing, the need for the soundbite, the need for the headline, and an enemy to progress is overstated, but unhelpful in the complexity of the moment?
Certainly, I think many of us can think about, read, become scholars of how we can and should communicate in times of a pandemic. I will say that if you have only 90 seconds to convey the complexity, that does it a disservice if you're not going to have a simple if you can't have a simple message, if you want to display the nuance. I will also say another complexity in the communication is that there were many places that public health was on the same page, that many of us agreed on 80%, 90% of things moving forward. And then there were, you know, 10, 20% of things at any given time where we didn't have enough data, where the right decision might have been gray because reasonable people could have come on down on two sides of the data, on either side of the data that we did have. Ultimately, what happened is that became really interesting news and controversy. And instead of focusing on the 80% of the places that we agreed, there was a lot of discussion about the 10 to 20 places, 20% of time where we might not have. And that actually, I think, did some work to erode trust as well.
I want to start looking to today and looking forward, Dr. Walensky. Just recently, the CDC announced a change to its guidance, no longer requiring a fixed period. It was at 5 days of isolation. If you had COVID, instead using loss of fever for more than 24 hours and reduction in symptoms as the guide. When the word came out that the CDC was likely to do that, we spoke with Dr. Shira Doron, who's chief infection control officer at Tufts Medical Center, and got her reaction as to whether she thought it was going to be a good move. Here she is.
I agree with that move. I don't think it will worsen the spread of infection, but let me be very clear. It's not that I think that people are no longer contagious when their fever is gone for 24 hours. It's that this new guideline aligns our approach to COVID with our approach to other respiratory viruses, all of which can have a contagious phase that extends beyond the period of acute illness.
What I want to focus on there, Dr. Walensky, is other respiratory viruses. There are those who, when we start to talk about COVID as anything other than an active pandemic, the active pandemic, find that deeply upsetting. I think maybe feeling it doesn't honor the experience and loss people have been through or the risk to those, for example, who are immunosuppressed, et cetera. This move to say COVID is one of a number of respiratory viruses that we have to keep our eyes on and we have to sort of unmake it special. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
Is that right? Is it time to make that change?
First, I think it is appropriate for CDC to follow the science, as I have frequently said, to reconsider that science in the backdrop of epidemiology and the social context and where we are in the moment. And I think that that's the responsibility of the agency, and they've taken that responsibility seriously. I do think that one of the things that happened during the COVID pandemic is that people started thinking about the immunocompromised population, the increasing size of the immunocompromised population because of some of our breakthroughs in medicine. And we've talked about them in the context of COVID. They also happen to be true in the context of our other respiratory viruses like flu and others and RSV. I generally think that I agree with Dr. Doron, and I would also say that among the things that is not emphasized is there are other things, including wearing masks and other things that the CDC focused on that said if you're going to leave isolation and you potentially are still contagious, to mask up to prevent spread, but also to just think about what you can do as an individual to protect someone else. And to recognize that, if you just had COVID 2 days ago and today is the day that your symptoms are better, that, it may be CDC guidance that it's okay to leave. But if you're going to visit a nursing home, maybe today's not the day to go. And to really sort of, one of the things I think we didn't do particularly well in the pandemic is to think of others. And I would really just encourage people to do that as they think about the implementation of these new guidances.
Is there a next one? And are we ready for it?
One of the reasons I'm delighted that you're having this conversation is because I do know that people don't want to talk about this anymore, and I appreciate that. What we know about zoonotic infections, what we know about infectious diseases, really do suggest that the question is not if, but when. Everyone expected that our next pandemic would be an influenza pandemic. And just because we got a COVID pandemic does not mean that we are protected from an influenza pandemic. And the reason that this is important is not to scare people off, but to continue the investments that we've made in health and public health so that we can continue to bolster what really was an incredibly frail public health infrastructure in this country. We are not where we need to be in terms of our workforce infrastructure. We're about 80,000 public health workers in deficit just to carry on day-to-day activities. Our data infrastructure and the way data flows in this country, and our laboratory infrastructure. And so if there is one lesson to be learned, it is that we've made a lot of strides. We can't lose ground, and we still need investments to get to the place that we as Americans deserve in terms of having a robust public health infrastructure to be maximally ready for the next time.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky, speaking with us yesterday, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health. She left her role as chief of infectious disease at Mass General to become head of the CDC in January of 2021. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We are marking 4 years since Charlie Baker, then the governor of Massachusetts, declared a COVID state of emergency. And our goal, learning from that history. We just heard from Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control, from January of 2021 to mid-2023. Dr. Ashish Jha also left a local job to take a national role. He departed Brown University's School of Public Health to become White House COVID Response Coordinator in 2022. He has since returned to his role of dean at the school. Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu became executive director of the Boston Public Health Commission in late 2021. And Professor Molly Colvin, a developmental neuropsychology, has been director of Mass General's Learning and Emotional Assessment Program since, wait for it, March of 2020. They're all here with us in Studio 2. Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Ashish Jha, welcome.
Thank you.
And Molly Colvin. Great
Thank
to
you.
Have you.
Nice to see you.
I want to start with reactions. And Ashish Jha, I'll turn to you first. Listening to that conversation with Rochelle Walensky 4 years out from the state of emergency, what'd you find yourself thinking?
So first of all, it was great to hear Rochelle's reflections. I got to work very closely with her when I was at the White House. It has been a very traumatic 4 years for the country, for obviously the people who've gone through so much suffering. But for all of those people who have worked on the front lines, I think this is an important moment to reflect. We are obviously in a better place. But Rochelle is absolutely right. We also have to use this moment to learn and make sure that we are better prepared for the future. I believe we are, but I think there is a lot of work still left to do.
Professor Molly Colvin, one of the things that was interesting was watching you listen to her, because there were lots of places where you nodded. Yeah. And so I'm wondering what was going on for you there?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about how we make decisions and how we make decisions under stressful situations, and how the COVID pandemic for many of us was unique in that it happened so quickly and it upended every aspect of our lives. So we were doing, I think, the best we could in many ways with the information that we had at the time. But in some ways, you know, looking back, it's easier to see how we could have done things differently or to second guess. But I think in the moment when she was talking about making the complexity of the decisions and the decision about how to make it simple or harder, those are difficult things to do when we're under stress. Our brains are not working as efficiently, and we were all experiencing anxiety and fear and wrestling with ambiguity, and trying to make complex decisions under those circumstances is a difficult thing for our brains to do.
So I'll key in on that, Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu, because, you know, sometimes you hear something a second time and you notice something. She said, when I asked her, that she was not caught off guard when that first phone call about infections at Mass General happened. And I found myself thinking, I thought we were all caught off guard. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that people weren't, but our systems were? Were you?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I'd like to say, you know, I really appreciated hearing from Dr. Walensky. She was also my division chief at MGH. So I really appreciate her leadership and the bravery that I think she withstood a lot during this last period of time that she led the CDC. You know, I have to be honest and say I was also not caught off guard. And part of that is being an infectious disease physician and knowing that it's, you know, almost inevitable that we will have these pandemics, that we will have these, you know, sort of life-altering events that lead to incredible challenges. I think that's part of it. But then part of it, too, being someone who focuses on health inequity and how do we address these ongoing issues, what we saw that I think was striking to some people was seeing so many people who were Black and Latinx and Indigenous die. And if you look back at the data, probably around April of 2020, we started to see these stark and just grotesque inequities in who was getting COVID and who was actually dying from COVID. And a lot of people, I did a lot of talks, I'm sure we all did around that time. And a lot of people said, well, aren't you shocked? This is, how could this be happening? Because we know that we have baseline inequities in our society that puts people at higher risk. We know people who are lower income are essential workers who are not going to be able to take time off and protect themselves. We know that they have comorbidities that put them at risk every single year during seasonal influenza time. We know that those are the people who are disproportionately impacted. So we were not surprised by what we were seeing. And that's my worry as we move towards this period of pandemic preparedness. What are we going to do that truly puts us in a better place going forward?
I do remember, Dr. Ashish Jha, a conversation on Radio Boston with Dr. Joseph Betancourt of MGH as that data was starting to come forward, and Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, just sort of laying the volume of data about the inequitable results of this pandemic out on the table and sort of staring at it. Okay, so now I've heard from all three of you. The question that's now burning for me is, if we weren't caught off guard, then how did we get our backside so badly kicked in Massachusetts by this thing?
Yeah, so I think I do agree that I think those of us who've been studying these issues were not caught off guard. In 2018, I did an interview where I was asked, what's the thing that keeps you most awake at night? And I said, the risk of a global pandemic, likely a virus, likely, an influenza pandemic. And anyway, the point is that we knew this risk existed, and we did not, as a society, as a world, really prepare for this risk. The risk hasn't gone away. One of the things that when I was in Washington, people would often say, well, this is a once in 100-year pandemic. Do we get a 100-year reprieve? And the answer is absolutely not. In fact, we have entered an age of pandemics where we're going to be dealing with this. So there are lots of ways in which we fail to prepare. We have made some progress, as Rochelle alluded to. But there's just a ton more work to do. And if we get another pandemic and we're still not prepared, it's going to be really hard to explain and excuse that.
So I'm going to bring us back into that moment again. Early on, this is Shira Derone, who's epidemiologist and chief infection control officer at Tufts Medical Center.
People sort of question, was it really that bad when the pandemic first arrived in the Boston area? It was really that bad. I mean, we legitimately had a refrigerated truck in the alley for the bodies that were stacking up. And so when you look at today, and most people are able to live their lives completely normally, I didn't actually think we would get here in 4 years.
So interesting sort of beginning of how bad an end we got here fairly fast. Two things I want to pull out of that. One is the mental health implications. And two is the supply questions. And we'll come to that one in a minute. Professor Molly Colvin, that does damage.
Yes, and I don't think we're out of the mental health consequences of this at all. In the clinic where I work, we see children and adolescents, and what we've seen is that there's just been a mental health crisis, especially among kids, but also among adults. And there are not enough providers. We're still sort of struggling with that. And I think a lot of that was that we made decisions that really impacted people's lives and threw them off guard. And in particular, one of the things that we've been thinking a lot about is the impact of school closures and sort of how long schools were closed. And the data that we see now is that while many children came through that fine, children who are already being impacted by disparities, by neurodevelopmental conditions, by learning disabilities, really suffered during that time. And we're still seeing the long-term consequences of that play out. And I think we will for a very long time to come. And I hope that we can take the lessons of that forward as we anticipate future pandemics, but also even just disruptions from climate change and that happen on a more routine basis.
We're here with Molly Colvin, Ashish Jha, and Bisola Ojukwutu reflecting on the fact that this weekend, 4 years since then Governor Charlie Baker declared the state of emergency, effectively shut things down. I know it's hard to talk about, but our task here today is, what can we learn? So, Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu, I'm going to play, following up on what Professor Molly Colvin just said, a little sound from Sandro Golea, who is the dean of Boston University School of Health, a medical doctor who wrote a book on sort of reflecting on what public health is getting right and wrong. And he said that public health may have failed to properly consider some trade-offs.
What we never had in public health was an honest conversation about what we were losing in endorsing keeping schools closed. We never had that conversation because the conversation was freighted in fear that if we open schools, it is all bad. Well, keeping schools closed also had its badness. And it was a bad, bad situation. I think for us as a society, we owed it to ourselves to have that conversation, which we never had.
And I want to note that in the book and in the conversation, he wasn't arguing that was a problem in April 2020, mm-hmm. right? There's an arc to this, but react to that.
So Dr. Galea is our chair of our Board of Health in the city of Boston. So we've talked a lot about this. I think that when something happens that's as catastrophic as this, and just to put it in context, 582 people died in April of 2020. Okay, that was the highest number of deaths in Boston from COVID-19. Right now, just to compare, we're down to under 5 deaths per month. Okay, so we've really, you know, come a long way in a relatively short period of time. So I just want to put that in context. At the time, there's fear, there's anxiety, there's, you know, overwhelming concern about the unknown. And you're going to make trade-offs and make decisions that now, in retrospect, we may not have done exactly the same way. So I think that those are the things that I think are part of this process of pandemic preparedness that we need to really be thinking through, the hard conversations about what will we do next time if we have a similar set of circumstances that we're presented with. Is it worth the mental health problems? And we've certainly tried to invest in youth mental health issues here in Boston, but we know there's so much work that needs to be done. We've got to have those difficult conversations. And that's one of the things I'm not sure we've learned yet, to be quite honest with you. So I think when you talk about lessons learned, we could go through a lot that I think we've progressed on, but others where I don't think we've touched the surface yet.
So all three of you have, in many of your answers, looked back and then said, and this was it, is what it means for going forward. And I'm anxious to do that. I think what we'll do is I want to do a couple more looks back, and then we'll take a pause, and then we'll spend the rest of the show on the now and forward. The other bucket, Dr. Ashish Jha, that's been on my mind a lot is decisions around process, material acquisition, that kind of thing. So I remember covering the live daily pressers for Governor Charlie Baker then, and talking about literally trying to get shipments of masks, right, to the port. There's the rollout of the first round of vaccines, tough online issues. Who did it go to first? Should it have gone to the big center? Should it have gone to CVS's in Walgreens? Should it have gone to pediatricians first? Not pediatricians, primary care doctors first because mm-hmm. of the ages. And then tests. I remember in 2021 trying to get a PCR for my son. It took us 5 hours of driving around to find a place we could get one. So what did we learn on the material side of it?
Yeah. So what we learned was we had a national and an international supply chain that had no resiliency built in, no ability to manage a crisis. For decades, we had built a supply chain that was driven by having the lowest cost product available. A lot of those things were in China. A lot of them were in other places. And when China shut down, a lot of those factories shut down. We had swabs being made in one factory in Italy for a period of time. When Italy got hit, the whole world couldn't get swabs. I think it's understandable how we got there, but what was very clear was that was not the way to function in a world where we were going to have more and more health crises, climate change was going to start stressing our systems. We needed a very different approach. By the time I arrived at the White House, it was very clear to me that ending the public health emergency meant making sure we have a very different looking supply chain as we think forward. I know we're still looking back. But I think the supply chain, all of the factors that go into vaccines, treatments, none of it was built for a crisis. And we have to start building systems that can manage crises.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we're continuing our reflection on 4 years of COVID-19 in Massachusetts. Our hash mark this weekend is when Governor Charlie Baker, then 4 years ago, declared the state of emergency here in the Commonwealth. Question is, how far we've come, what we can learn for the future. Still with us, Professor Molly Colvin, who's a developmental neuropsychologist at Harvard Medical School and director of Mass General's Learning and Emotional Assessment Program, Dr. Bisola Ojikutu, who's a executive director of the Boston Public Health Commission, and Dr. Ashish Jha, who's dean of Brown School of Public Health and a former White House COVID response, the former White House COVID response coordinator. So now we said we got to start looking at now and forward. We reached out to our texting group and asked them what they thought of the change just within the last week or two from the CDC, saying no more mandatory 5-day isolation period. Now, stay home when you're sick, and then when you've been fever-free for 24 hours and or your symptoms are reducing, you can go back out into the world. I want to give you two responses, and if you want to join our texting group, 617-766-0382, you send the word Boston there. So Christina from Somerville says, I think the new guidelines aren't fair to immunocompromised people and put an undue burden on those who have chronic health decisions. Stephen from Foxborough says, agree with the new rules, should have done them way earlier, no concerns, should have reopened schools and colleges and society much earlier. So, I mean, right there in our community, Radio Boston listeners, Professor Molly Colvin, how important is it for people to agree with those decisions in order to embrace them and feel safe with them?
That's an excellent question. And I think that we always act with more when we're aligned, when our values and our beliefs are aligned with our actions. That's always an easier place for us to be. When there is discordancy, when we're not in alignment, when we may have personal beliefs that are not necessarily aligned with what society is doing, that causes a lot of tension and a lot of stress. And it requires us to spend a lot of energy thinking about how we resolve those two extremes in those dialects. And that's not easy for people to do. And I think some people just by nature have more flexibility than others. I think there are people who are very adaptable and can go along and be resilient in any situation. But I think if we know that people already have some of that resilience depleted by chronic stress or by trauma or by grief or by loss or all of these things that people were more likely to experience during the pandemic, I think it's much harder for us to do that kind of cognitive work. And I think it's one of the reasons why our society is potentially so polarized right now. And we see people having very strong reactions to public health guidance that may not necessarily have elicited those same degree of responses before the pandemic.
Dr. Bisola Ojikutu, here's a little bit of Shira Daron, who's Chief Infection Control Officer at Tufts Medical Center, on air with us when we heard the CDC was likely to make this change, talking about education in particular, how things have been affected.
I'm very concerned about this issue of chronic absenteeism in school, which has only worsened since the school closures associated with the COVID pandemic. I do feel like we have sent a message to some families and some children that school is not important. And I think that this could be part of the solution to that problem.
This being the change in CDC guidelines. So, one, I'll ask obviously if you agree or not. And two, what are other things we need to repair in the moment as we invest for the next one?
Mm-hmm. So, I hear Dr. Daron's concern. I think there are always going to be competing priorities, which I think we all have to consider. I think that also our world is polarized. You know, it's always going to be polarized. I don't think that this is so, you know, unique, the text messages that you read either. You know what I mean? The fact that one person thinks one thing, another person thinks another thing. I think as public health leaders, and I, you know, can say just as the executive director of the Boston Public Health Commission, we constantly have to think about how do we protect populations as a whole? What is it that we can do to mitigate risk? And in the case of these new guidelines, I believe that we're in a different place than we were previously. So it makes sense that guidance changes. So that makes sense. However, one of the rationales behind changing the guidelines has been that we have tools, that we have tools that are available. And these tools are wonderful. These tools are the vaccines, the updated COVID-19 vaccine. We have Paxlovid. We have therapies that work well, you know. And from my perspective, as both a physician and a public health leader, I have to say to myself, okay, that's great. We have tools. But does everybody have access to those tools? Is everybody utilizing those tools? Is that the way that we work on a population level to ensure that this does not cause a challenge for those people who are both either immunocompromised or have comorbid illness or the elderly? So here in Boston, only 20% of Boston residents have received that updated COVID-19 vaccine. I'm heartened by the fact that more older individuals have, because we know that they're at highest risk. But in terms of Paxlovid, not very many people are using it at all. And I have many patients, you know, I still practice. I have many patients who have, you know, contracted COVID. They don't call me for Paxlovid. They don't even know what that is. And it goes back to our communication strategy and how are we truly moving forward as we prepare to make sure that people even know that these tools exist. And sometimes our guidance precedes our ability to engage communities and actually make sure that they know what's happening. And that was our worry, particularly when this guidance came out, to be quite honest with you, is that are we prepared? Have our communities prepared for this change?
So, Dr. Ashish Jha, two things that I heard there, I'm going to toss them up. You're going to pick one of them. Towards the beginning, the competing priorities piece, and towards the end, the access and ensuring access piece. You pick one.
Well, Let me take on both of them in the following way. First of all, and I think Sandra said this earlier in the conversation, is that public health always has competing priorities. And making them explicit, helping people understand what those trade-offs are, is part of good guidance. Good guidance almost never is about here's what you must do under all circumstances. It is always about helping people understand what are the burdens we're asking people to impose on themselves and their families, what are the benefits for themselves and their families and their communities. And I just wrote a piece about very supportive of this change in guidance, largely saying this is the right thing at this moment. Would it have been the right thing 2 years ago? No. 4 years ago, it would have been a disaster. But we're in a different place. Now, let's talk about the access issue. This is hard because I probably spend more time thinking about this and working on this than anything else in the last couple of years. We are a deeply inequitable country, and we have deeply inequitable health systems. Mm-hmm. And there are people who say, well, until we fix those things, we can't move forward on guidance like this. Well, I wish we could fix those things quickly and easily. They are going to be with us for a while. So what kind of progress can we make? We said, you know, when we ended the public health emergency, it needed to end. Congress had stopped funding these things. We said, let's make sure there's a program for the uninsured so uninsured Americans can get access to vaccines for free. Let's make sure there's a program for the uninsured and underinsured so they can get access to Paxlovid for free. There are efforts that we and others are trying to make to lower those barriers. Do I think that alone solves all of our inequity problems? Not anywhere close. So we have to understand that, like, we've got to continue that work of equity in an ongoing way while trying to guide the whole country forward with a pandemic that has been devastating, but we're in a different place with it now.
What about inequities in mental health response and mental health needs now?
I think this has been just absolutely devastating to see up close and personally every day in the number of children who need services and can't access them. We face that here in the Commonwealth and not having enough providers. But I think we also, you know, learned a lesson here that I hope we don't forget around the role that schools play in terms of mental health and
I'm just going to note nods from the other panelists here.
And in structuring kids' worlds and the numbers of children who access mental health services in schools is actually greater than the numbers of children who access mental health services anywhere else. And so we also use schools as sort of a primary means of nutrition and healthcare. And that's particularly true for children who are impacted by racial and economic disparities. And so I think what we have, you know, one of the lessons I really hope we can carry forward here is that for the inequity got wider over the course of the pandemic for those populations and for those children. And we have a lot of catch up to play here. And I'm worried about the size of the gap and how big it's gotten. And I'd really like for us to sort of learn some lessons here so that we don't do that in the future.
Okay. Yeah. Molly Colvin, Ashish Jha, Bisola Ojukwutu, we have just a few minutes left. So I am going to sort of shift us into sixth gear here, all right, and ask a little bit more rapid-fire questions as we think about what comes next. What is one thing we could do to keep people safe in the next pandemic and keep schools open? Who's got it?
There is no one thing, but there are multiple. No, look, I wish there was. They're just, okay, so if you're going to force me to pick one thing on respiratory illnesses, I want to have better indoor air quality.
Okay.
Indoor air quality can make an enormous difference, but do I think that should be our entire national strategy?
No. And like, I just mean pick one thing.
So let me start with that.
Great. What is one thing that we can do to ensure better access to the necessary supplies, whether it is protection supplies or medicines, vaccines, et cetera, next time around?
Well, what I would say really from the perspective of a local health department, we need to work on our own infrastructure. Our own supply chains were not functioning very well. I mean, we've over-ordered some supplies, under-ordered others. We literally have, you know, boxes of things that we don't need, you know, of PPE, personal protective equipment that we don't need. I think that building our public health infrastructure and making sure we are stronger so that we are able to provide what people need, I think is a big piece of the puzzle in terms of supplies. But I also think that it, you know, and Dr. Jha can speak more about the bigger picture of supply and supply chains, but I also think that it is about us having a better and stronger investment in just primary health care and in our federally qualified health centers. All of these things are not what we invest in necessarily, and they're not necessarily what we amplify and what we spend a lot of time thinking about. So I would like for us to do more on that end, and I think that could do a lot as we prepare moving forward.
So Dr. Walensky said at the top, worry about a shortage of public health workers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Our colleague Priyanka Dayal McCluskey's reporting in March 2023 on, you know, massive shortages over time, concerns in both primary care physicians, doctors, nurses, potentially 100,000 left 100,000 left the workforce during the pandemic. What about people? What about that one worries me.
In the sense of what how people
capacity.
Are responding.
Capacity. Yeah.
You know, I think that we have been operating sort of under this state of chronic stress and adaptability and flexibility. And on the one hand, you know, there's some silver linings here. I think we've all learned ways of operating in our worlds that are more resilient and more flexible, and maybe we can do that differently. But on the other hand, I think that takes a toll over time. It really decreases our ability to kind of, you can't sustain that over the long term. And this has been a marathon. And sometimes in a marathon, you have to sort of preserve your energy. I do think we have a moment here to regroup and to think about what our priorities should be, and building in layers within the system to kind of support people.
There is so much more, but we are out of time because we live by the clock. So Professor Molly Colvin, developmental neuropsychologist at MGH, Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu, executive director of the Boston Public Health Commission, Dr. Ashish Jha, currently dean of Brown University School of Public Health. I think there's a round two in year five that we should do, but thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.